Taking Stock with Vincent Wall. This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk with me, Vincent Wall. This is where we take a wider view of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. We're joined now by Fred Hochberg, former chairman and president of the United States Export-Import Bank and author of Trade is Not a Four-Letter Word, How Six Everyday Products Make the Case for Trade. Fred, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, we like to think that here in Ireland, we don't need to explain the benefits of trade, Fred, because while we're a very small economy, bobbling along the surface of the Atlantic, we are one of the most open economies in the world. But it seems that in the United States now, there is a need to explain the benefits of trade. And I presume that's why you've written this book.
Exactly. I served for 8 years as President Obama's chairman and president of our Export-Import Bank. And over that period of time, I just noticed how trade got so misunderstood, became a four-letter word, was seen as a source of a lot of what was wrong with America. And it was not from my perspective, because my job was to promote and boost exports from the U.S., many of which to Ireland, in fact, and so the benefits of trade. So that's what made me write the book. And I'm hoping we can have a more realistic conversation, a more balanced conversation, not just on the show today, but around the world about the benefits of trade.
Why do you think the attitude to trade, for those who understood how it works at all, why do you think the attitude has changed over recent years in the United States?
Well, I think a lot of it in the U.S. in particular, much of it goes back to what was the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. And the interesting thing about NAFTA, and it relates to the EU, the NAFTA, the idea of it was actually started by Ronald Reagan when he saw the European Union forming into a more formidable economic and trading bloc. He was concerned for American competitiveness. And thus was born the idea that we need to find a way in the United States, going to President Reagan, to blend together, meld together, intertwine U.S., Canada, and Mexico. So it first started with Canada, then expanded to Mexico. And one of the things that happened with that is we became a more integrated economy, the three economies, and have prospered enormously. But in some Midwestern states, where some manufacturing did move south, some also moved to Canada, there was a lot of dislocation and disruption. And we didn't do a very good job as a country acknowledging that. It's part of it's probably our American pioneer spirit, but we didn't really acknowledge the disruption we did to people's lives, how we uprooted them, how we uprooted jobs and livelihoods and cultures, and it gave that a bad taste. On top of that, Vincent, the states that got really badly impacted initially by the North America Free Trade Agreement happened to be what we call in our country battleground states. And you're going to hear a lot about that, more about that in the months to come as we approach November. And these are states that either go Democrat or Republican in an election, and that very much determines who will win the presidency. So that, I think, has kept trade at the forefront and has given it a somewhat, for some, a more toxic or negative cast.
You approach the whole area of trade in a very engaging way, and very entertaining way, I must say, in terms of the six products, everything from a taco bowl to a Honda Odyssey to the service trade of education. But let's take one of those, the iPhone, which I suppose to most people around the world, myself included, is seen as an American brand, Apple, but everything in it is Chinese. Not necessarily so.
Absolutely not. That's probably a quirk of how products and what's called rules of origin, ROO, but where does a product come from? And the issue with the iPhone is it is assembled, it's put together in China. And the way the World Trade Organization and generally the globe looks at it, the country that transforms a product the most is where it is considered to come from. So the iPhone is assembled in China. The rare earth usually comes from either the Congo or Rwanda. The chip in the iPhone that tracks how many steps you take. And Vincent, I'm sure you did your 10,000 steps today. That comes from the Netherlands. If you hold the iPhone upright or sideways, portrait or landscape, that little gyroscope comes from a company in Switzerland. The display actually comes from Samsung, Apple's big competitor in Korea. The glass that occasionally does crack, I might add, comes from Corning, New York. So, but all of these products, all these components, all these intermediate goods are shipped to China and assembled into the iPhone. So it is considered by you and Americans as a Chinese import, and yet only about $8.50 of an iPhone is actually cost attributed to China. The rest comes from all those other places and many more I didn't even mention around the world. So the iPhone, one, we wouldn't have even have an iPhone without globalism and global trade. And two, I use it in the book to try and explain we don't really understand what's an American product, what's a Chinese product, and the whole idea of these bilateral trade deficits making a difference is simply rubbish.
And that's in the case of a physical product like an iPhone, whose convenience we all understand, but there's a whole plethora of exports, trade, imports and exports in the whole area of services. You point out the service of a college education or the huge American service of entertainment exports.
Absolutely. And listen, one of the things we did a lot of business with when I chaired the Export-Import Bank for President Obama was in the aircraft leasing field. You know, we provided enormous financing to Ryanair at a time and to many of the aircraft leasing firms that are located in Ireland. And that's a giant service business. I mean, Ireland is is a country, in my opinion, at the forefront of what we're going to see in the 21st century, an economy very much reliant on services, which is where the global economy is going. So absolutely so, whether it's aircraft leasing, financing, technology, entertainment, I talk about Game of Thrones, education, these are all, in many cases, the exports of the future and the exports of today.
And I presume most Americans, if they think about trade at all in an objective way, don't see Hollywood as a vast export business.
Exactly. And in fact, the entertainment business in America, TV, radio, movies, games, computer games, is about an $800 billion industry. It is an enormous industry. About a quarter of that is exported. We export more entertainment than all of aerospace, which is the largest product export area, more than education, more than tourists. So it is a huge industry, employs many people, and it's not just people on the screen, but it employs many what are quote-unquote blue-collar workers, sound technicians, set designers, people in catering, transportation, all of those fields that create enormous amount of jobs and very good paying jobs. And that's frequently overlooked. We seem to be attached to and understand physical exports, cars, airplanes. We don't really export locomotives. We did a lot of freight locomotives when I was at Export-Import Bank, but we don't really think about the service part of the equation.
You're listening to Taking Stock on News Talk with me, Vincent Wall. I'm speaking with Fred Hochberg, author of Trade is Not a Four-Letter Word. Fred, we were referencing China there in terms of where iPhones are assembled. You do write in the book that China has been a bad actor in terms of trade. What do you mean by that?
Well, China joined the World Trade Organization around 2001. And it was hoped that they would adopt more of sort of Western practices and norms both around the economy and around personal liberty. They certainly have prospered enormously as an economy. We have seen, and particularly recently with Hong Kong, a whole abrogation of civil rights, human rights, free speech. So that part did not happen. But in the terms of trade and the terms of the economy, it is still very much a state-controlled economy. They have what are called state-owned enterprises. Sometime you'll see if you're reading SOE, state-owned enterprises, where the government has, frankly, under Xi Jinping, an increased hand in the practices of state-owned enterprises. There have been widespread abuses of intellectual property, the kinds of things that where people invent ideas in countries that China has seen fit to simply appropriate. Also requiring what I call technology transfers, where if you're going to operate in China and sell to China, you're going to have to bring some of that technology there that may then fall into Chinese hands because your business has a partnership. Now, why don't companies just say, well, we're not going to stand for that? The reason is, with China being the second largest economy in the world, you know, north of a billion people, a middle class that's frankly larger than the population of the entire United States, it is a very enticing and very lucrative market. So you have the appeal of the market and yet a number of practices that put companies and the sort of secret sauce of what frequently Western companies have come up with in jeopardy. And that makes this a very difficult situation.
And I suppose has soured the whole attitude of the current administration in particular towards the very notion of trade. You have a lot of dedications in the book, but you actually dedicated to Donald Trump as well. a strange choice. Why so?
Well, as you notice, it's the last dedication in the book. And I said, and to President Donald Trump, perhaps an unlikely source who moved the conversation about tariffs and trade from the back page of the business section to page A1 of our newspapers. And the reason I did acknowledge Donald Trump is he has put a spotlight on trade. And frankly, Vincent, this COVID pandemic, this crisis the global is grappling with, has also made people understand what a supply chain is. A year ago, when you talked about a supply chain, people had no idea what you were talking about. We now understand, when it comes to personal protective equipment and so forth, what supply chains are. So what Donald Trump has done is said he has put a spotlight on trade, and frankly, to the exclusion of things like the environment, human rights, civil rights, free speech, but he's put a spotlight on trade. What is squandered, however, now that he has the world's attention on trade and China's attention, we haven't used that to really substantially move the conversation forward to a more balanced trade, a more fair trade. How do we developed and less developed countries operate? How do we make sure that governments don't put the finger on the scale to help certain industries at the expense of others? So I applaud him for putting trade in the center of it, but I think it's a squandered opportunity.
And while he has signed a new trade agreement with Canada and Mexico to succeed NAFTA, obviously the whole issue with China and other trading blocs as well has been very soured under his administration. Do you think trade is in long-term retreat, Fred? Or if Biden wins in November, do you think it may be resuscitated a little bit? It may become more open again?
Well, yes, I do. First of all, trade, particularly in goods, has declined since the global financial crisis of over a decade ago. And, you know, there was a time that trade was growing at twice the level of global gross domestic product. It's now growing at that level or a little bit less. So I think there's less trade in goods, partly because more countries have industrialized. There's more trading within countries and within regions than across the globe in the sense it used to be. So I think that's the trade. We also have more trade in services, which is harder to track. But clearly, President Biden is someone who I've known for over 30 years, who values global relationships, values the fact that we benefit more. You know, we're trying to find a cure or at least a vaccine for this terrible virus. It's a worldwide effort, and we want to make sure wherever it's discovered and enhanced, the whole world benefits, and that requires global trade and global cooperation. And that's something clearly President Biden does believe in, and clearly something that President Trump and his administration do not believe in.
Whatever way it goes over the coming years, there will always be winners and losers in this global trade game, if I can call it that. Do you think we definitely need to learn the lessons of looking after the losers better, if we may call them losers, and also to prepare the next generation of those hit by the negatives of trade to deal with it better?
Yes, I think two things, actually, Vince, I agree with you. One of the, I think, colossal failures of our country is we did not take adequate stock and adequate support of people who lost out to trade, lost their jobs, lost their livelihood, lost their sense of dignity, their sense of being a breadwinner. And one of the other things that clearly came through in my work on this book is the need for what someone used the term lifelong readiness. More than lifelong learning, you know, many people, they finish high school and they're thrilled to be done with formal education. But all of us thinking about how to be lifelong ready, it's just like you and I would have to prepare if there's a bad storm, you may have to buy extra food, put fuel in the car or petrol in the car. If we have to be prepared for a life that's going to have many changes in our career, in our work environment, in our use of technology. So having all of us being lifelong ready, so when a job disruption or an economic disruption happens, that's not the time to like learn a new language. We should be learning that all along, so we're constantly prepared, constantly more valuable, and constantly able to take on more and more challenges.
You mentioned gas in the car. I presume the car outside in your yard, Fred, is a Honda Odyssey, as you write, the most American of all cars.
The Honda Odyssey, the only thing is, if I had a Honda Odyssey, I would need to have about six children as well, because it does hold a lot of people. But I was fortunate to visit the Honda Odyssey assembly plant, and I use the word assembly plant for exactly the whole point of supply chains. Cars are assembled. They're not manufactured. You know, the seats come from someplace, the tires, the radio, the shock absorbers, the brake, all come from different places. I had a chance to visit the Honda assembly plant, saw the first Honda that came off that line at the turn of this century. I was proud to be there and proud to see the people who actually put those cars together.
And your point being, it's more American than Ford.
And far more American than Ford. And frankly, the Ford 150 pickup truck, what people think is an iconic American brand, is just over 50% U.S. parts and components, and the Honda Odyssey tops in around 75%.
Well, it's a very engaging and informative book, but we'll leave it there. That's Fred Hochberg, former chairman and president of the United States Export-Import Bank, and author of Trade is Not a Four-Letter Word, How Six Everyday Products Make the Case for Trade. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it, Vincent.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings. You can also follow us for updates on Twitter at TakingStockNT. And you'll find the podcast from early Friday mornings at newstalk.com, on the News Talk app, or wherever you get your podcasts. My thanks to the production team of Steve Daunt, Simon Keane, and Stephen Jordan. So from Taking Stock with me, Vincent Wall, take it easy.